From WWNO, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. This and every week we talk to people in Louisiana who've devoted their lives to music. We want to hear about their experiences and listen to what they're listening to, because that's where our music comes from. This week, travel logs from some of our most delightful recent guests: Jim McCormick, John Cleary, Alex McMurray, the Pfister Sisters, and Shannon Powell.
The bus pulled off from the hotel to go to the airport, and I was in the little greasy spoon getting some of that, some of that Sir Flaky. I'm getting some more of that because every corner they got them, you know.
Right.
So I get back to the hotel. I'm thinking everybody's still in their room, and, you know. And I look around. Hey, hold on. My bag is gone.
Uh-oh. Did Powell miss the bus from Greece? Stay tuned. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. Louisiana musicians routinely circle the planet, and they've got the stories to prove it. Shannon Powell could write a book about all the places he's been while traveling around the world with jazz greats like Harry Connick Jr., Diana Krall, Wynton Marsalis, and rock and roller Tommy Ridgely, among others. Make that a cookbook. Powell likes to eat.
I can cook a little bit.
Yeah, you've got a very precise palate there.
Yeah, I used to cook on the road in my room, you know. Yeah.
Did you ever see that movie Round Midnight?
Of course.
That with Dexter Gordon.
Yes.
And he's in Paris, and there's like this little place, like a little hotel or apartment building where a bunch of American jazz musicians are playing, and every time they would shoot that, you know, the hallway, some guy would come out of his room and say, "You want some ribbies?"
Yeah.
Be the greatest city in the world if I could just find some okra.
What the hell do you know about Paris, Ace? You don't do nothing but stay in that damn room in your robe and slippers cooking all day.
At least I'm doing it in Paris.
Well, that's what musicians do for years, you know. If you know how to cook, you know, you bring a little hot plate on the road. I had two of them.
Wow.
I used to travel with my pots in my drum case, in my trap case. And I've been known to get out, put out of many hotels.
Really?
Yeah.
For cooking, yeah. You're cooking and you're cooking.
The maid smelled it in the hallway, and she'd be like, "What's going on in there?" I said, "Nothing." I said, "I just come to the store." She said, "No, you cooking in there."
Nailed you.
That was smothered chicken.
You cannot be serious.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
you were smothering chicken in your hotel room.
Smothered chicken in the hotel room with rice and green peas and everything. I called Harry. I said, "Harry, you want some New Orleans food?" "Yeah, man." I said, "Come in my room." Harry, come. He can't believe. He said, "Man, I got potato salad and green peas and smothered chicken." Harry said, "Man, this is unbelievable." He said, "Man, how you did this?
You making groceries on the road?"
Yes, indeed. I got so tired of eating Kentucky Fried Chicken and Arby's and you know, I couldn't live off that stuff. And going downstairs and eating for $50, $60, eating some garbage for $50, $60, room service.
So you're making your own.
Go to the store, come back, plug up. We just have to be careful because some of the hotel rooms weren't
set up
for the plug. So you have to make sure your hot plate is not too powerful. See, throw the power out. See.
How you gonna smother chicken on a low flame?
I guess you can. Trust me, I did it. Trust me, I was cooking meatballs, spaghetti, everything.
Maybe you should have given the maid a little bit of your food and she would have ratted you out.
Oh, I have done that.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
I've really fed the maids all over the world. Literally. Here, have a plate from New Orleans. Real New Orleans. Real New Orleans. What you tell me? Real New Orleans here.
Excellent.
Yeah, and they come back, "Oh, it's so good." I said, "Thank you." Now don't go rat me out now.
Exactly. That's fair trade, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, yeah. Everybody in the band knew I cook. Everybody in the band, they called me up, "Man, you cooking today?" I said, "Yep." They want to put in, see? I didn't want to put in. Okay. I said, "Come on, bring your money." I have an opportunity to play with some great rock and roll people like Mr. Tommy Ridgely.
I love Tommy Ridgely. I'm looped.
Girl, come here. Boy, you tell.
Yes, I'm looped. High as a Georgia pine. Yes, I'm looped. High as a Georgia pine. Well, I got a pocket full of money and I sure am feeling fine.
Such a good song.
Yeah.
I love it. I listen to it a lot, I have to say. I don't know what that says about me, but I listen to it.
Oh, man.
Yes.
He's so funny.
He really is funny.
We had a chance to go to Greece together. I went with him.
Really?
We went way to Greece, and we opened up for Curtis Mayfield. This was years ago.
I'd like to see that show.
The bus pulled off from the hotel to go to the airport, and I was in the little greasy spoon getting some of that Sir Flaky. You know, I'm getting some more of that because every corner they got them, you know.
Right, the lamb.
Yeah, I'm getting the lamb, and, you know. So I get back to the hotel. I'm thinking everybody's still in their room, and, you know. And I look around. Wait, hold on. My bag is gone.
Uh-oh.
I went back in the lobby. I said, the guy said, what the big bus? He said, oh, they're gone. I said, what? So Tommy said, we got 3 blocks. And I told him, I said, look, there's something ain't right on this bus. Because I used to talk a lot back then, you know. You know, everybody looking for the talker, you know. Tommy said, man, something ain't right on this bus. He said, man, you know what? Shannon ain't on this bus. They had to come back to get me. They had to left me.
To get you out of Greece.
Good thing Tommy realized how quiet the bus was. Oh, my God.
All because you were jamming on some lamb.
Yep, that lamb was good.
I
tell a guy in the
it.
French Quarter, I said, man, you don't have the real lamb. I've been to Greece, man.
There you go. That's right. You tell him.
That's a Winn-Dixie lamb. You got to go.
Winn-Dixie lamb.
You got the Winn-Dixie lamb.
Bad.
You know.
Yes, it's true. Oh, gosh. Well, so in terms of Harry Connick Jr., why did you come off the road? Why did you leave?
Well, after I had my little disagreement with Harry's management.
Really?
That's what I tell people, you know, it had nothing to do with Harry, just a little misunderstanding with me and his management. We started seeing different, you know, we weren't seeing eye to eye, and the ride came to an end.
Right.
You know, yeah, that's all it was.
Mm-hmm. And so when
business
was that?
Business as usual.
When was that?
This was back in 1998, was it? Yeah, 98.
And you came back off the road and you came back to New Orleans?
I came back to New Orleans and I just started working here in the city and then started traveling out as a solo, you know, side man. Right after that, I got the gig with Winton with the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
Because he had two bands going on the road at that time. He had two Lincoln Center bands traveling all over. And I was with the second band. Of course, Earlham was with the first band.
Earlham Riley.
Yeah. Second band. So there was times when like Winton would be splitting time. You know, he'd come with the second band, he'd go with the first band. Winton was all over the place.
Hey, you know, he's not like a polygamist. He's got a couple of wives in these bands, you know?
It was great.
Wow.
And then right after that, I joined with Miss Diana Krall.
Yeah.
And I got a gig. I was doing a little work with Mr. Herb Ellis, a wonderful guitar player. I did some stuff with him until he got really ill.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been nonstop since Harry.
It seems like it's been nonstop.
Yeah,
it really does. It's nice
God
to be in demand,
that.
Isn't it?
Yeah, well, thank God for that.
Okay, here we go.
Shannon Powell and Wynton Marsalis never really said goodbye. In the lead up to Super Bowl 47, they played together for CBS Sunday Morning. The Baltimore Ravens and San Francisco 49ers took the field in the Superdome that day, but the hometown players rolled out What else? When the saints go marching in. Was the one. Shannon Powell and Wynton Marsalis.
Sing, 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 everybody start to sing, 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 sing,
sing, sing, sing, sing, Holly Benson, Amissi Miller, and Yvette Volker are the Pfister Sisters. They've sung for everyone from prisoners at Angola State Penitentiary in Louisiana to European audiences. Yvette Volker keeps the travel log.
Well, we don't travel as much as we might would like to because there's always been a child, at least one, usually several.
Although, to be fair, my kids travel really, really well.
Yeah,
that's
but
good.
It does,
and have.
You know, it,
and have.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
but you, it tips the scale.
Right, but nobody ever asked Keith Richards, well, so where are
right.
the kids? You
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
Well,
because
he probably wouldn't even know.
Exactly.
Right.
How are you managing somewhere. The kids, you know?
Well, I mean, Amissi was the primary mom to his first daughter, and she came with us on our first road trip.
That's fantastic.
You know, so we, mm-hmm. you know, we've... Yeah.
We've almost never had a rehearsal where there was a child hanging on somebody's leg and
yes.
crying. It's like... We don't know how to do that.
Yvette, you write a blog that sort of talks about what road life is like for a group. And, I pulled one of your blog entries
okay.
From the Times-Picayune newspaper. This is back from 2008.
Ah, yes.
When you were in Germany.
Oh, okay. Oh, I like this one. Okay, today, Thursday, a group of us meet to go to the zoo. It's huge, a little overwhelming, and very exotic. Lots of animals I've never seen before, including several polar bears and a panda. Some of the buildings, like the giraffe house, date from the 1800s and are beautiful, but some of the enclosures for the big cats and the monkeys are small and reminiscent of the old Audubon Zoo. Home again to an interesting email. The hotel has reported Debbie to the cabaret, they're paying the bill, for apparently not keeping her room clean enough. It seems that the cleaning ladies have complained about actually having to clean her room. What? Have I missed something here? I have been summoned to a meeting to discuss a solution to this problem. I am so tired of trying to figure out what's a cultural issue, what's a translation issue, and what really needs to be addressed. Next time, road manager for sure.
I love that blog post. It's hard to, you're right, it's hard to tell what's a cultural issue, what's a serious issue, what's not.
Or just translation. Or just, I mean, because the Germans spoke very good English, but it very often we were talking right past
each other. We just didn't get each other.
By mere best of shame, please let me explain. By mere best of shame means you're grand. By mere best of shame, again I'll explain. It means you're the fairest in the land. I could say Bella, Bella, even say.
Debbie Davis, I'm giving you a chance to rebut. Rebut the Germans.
I have to, oh boy, I told the same story on a blog that I was writing at the same time, which was not on the Times-Picayune's webpage.
Yeah, well, I was trying to be kinder.
For reasons that you will understand if you read my blog. I took the kids out to the playground one day and came back to find the hotel manager and both of the maids in my room with a camera.
You caught them in the act.
I did. Yeah. I caught them in the act.
Oh, no.
To be fair, I don't know if it was a cultural thing or a misunderstanding or if these people were just a bunch of jerks and they were looking for the slow gazelle to jump on, which you're traveling with two kids. You're the slow gazelle. And I realize now that I was an easy mark. But, you know, the kids were great. And other than some crying that I did perfunctorily after this incident with the hotel manager, it was, I try to look back on it as a good trip, but, you know, I think my rider will be much more specific next.
Changing the weather, changing the sea. From now on, there'll be a change in me. My walk will be different, my talk and my name. Nothing about me is gonna be the same. I'm gonna change my way of living, if that ain't enough. I'll change the way that I strut my stuff. Nobody wants you when you're old and gray. There'll be some changes made today. There'll be some changes made.
That's the Pfister Sisters with There'll Be Some Changes Made. Back in a minute with more travel stories from some of Louisiana's finest musicians. Stay with us. It's Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. This week, we're hearing stories from Louisiana musicians about their experiences on the road. A song by Alex McMurray can take you anywhere you want to go, from a runaway train to a World War I battlefield to the soggy bottom of the sea to, well, Texas.
Lying here wasted with the cold running through me, throwing my past on the fire. The shadows stretching away to forever, and the boys are about to retire. The smell of the diesel and the feel of the damp have come to be my own. I'm holding steady, but I ain't near ready to go back to Texas again.
But life is often stranger than fiction. At one point during his career, McMurray traveled to the other side of the world to become Captain Sandy, singer of sea shanties.
Well, where is me wench? Me nuggy, nuggy wench. She's all gone for beer and tobacco. Well, her tail's all torn out and her front is ripped about. And her she's looking out for better weather.
How did you fall into sea shanty work?
Well, like all good stories, it involves Disney.
Really?
Sure, yeah. About 10 years ago, maybe longer, I got this job working at Tokyo Disney Sea.
Of course.
It's a park. It's the park next to Disneyland.
In Tokyo.
I was there to sing sea shanties for Japanese tourists.
And so did Disney call you directly for this job?
No, I was hired through a guy named Adam Shipley. He's a showbiz impresario from way back. But he had a guy at Disney who every once in a while would call him up and say, hey, I need a guy, you know, who can... juggle plates on sticks, or you know, I need a ventriloquist act, you know.
This is great.
And so this guy Shipley said, you know, one day the guy called Shipley and said, you know, I need a guy who can like play guitar and banjo and sing sea shanties, you know.
Wow.
For not this park here, not in Orlando, but like for the Japanese park. And so this guy Shipley, he called our friend Glenn Hartman, accordionist for the New Orleans Klezmer All Stars, and said, "All right, I got a guy who's looking for a guy who can sing sea shanties, or you know, play the guitar, play banjo, and sing."
Thank God.
And so Glenn said, "What about Alex?" And Shipley said, without missing a beat, he said, "No, it's Disney, Glenn." Anyway, that's the way I was told it went down. It years later, Glenn was like, "Oh, I got you that gig," he said.
There you go. So anyway, was he implying that you weren't wholesome enough for Disney?
I think the wholesomeness was part of the equation, yeah. There was maybe not enough wholesomeness.
Not wholesome enough for the Magic Kingdom.
Not enough wholesome.
All right.
So like 3 weeks later, I was on a plane going to Japan. This is the best part. I called Shipley and I said, "Shipley, am I going to need to know sea shanties?" He's like, "I don't think so, but here's somebody you could call." So he gave me this number, somebody in Orlando, and I said, "Listen, I'm going to be going over as Captain Sandy. I need to know if I need to know sea shanties going in." They're like, "Oh, no, well, they'll show you everything on the other side."
Nice.
"Are you sure?" They said, "Absolutely. Don't even worry about it. I just go, enjoy it.
The Japanese
time.
Have sea shanties licked."
They've got it all figured out for you.
Okay.
So I get there. Costume fitting and orientation and all this stuff, and then like finally we're in this rehearsal. We're sitting in like in some big room with a conference table, and there's all this chattering back and forth in Japanese, and I'm there with the other Captain Sandy, this guy named Newbern Johnson, and finally the translator looks at us and says, "So, make sea shanty." And I'm like, "You mother." And so John, Newbern John, that's his name was, he called
the
himself
other
John.
Captain Sandy.
The other Captain Sandy.
Sandy,
he was like a 64-year-old guy from Gainesville who knew about 350 sea shanties.
No
he knew
way.
Like six versions of the same song. He immediately starts, "Oh, he plays, you know, John Kanaka or something like that." And then they turn to me, and I don't know. I mean, I think I remembered from my audition, like, "Blow the Man Down." You know,
okay.
Like two verses of "Blow the Man Down." And I think I might have repeated the first verse just to...
just for emphasis.
Just to, like... And then so, you know, John kind of like looks at me, okay. Then he does another one. And then that was all I had. So I like, when it was my turn again, I did one of my own songs.
Good, good.
Some song, which is... Like,
let's hear it.
You want to hear it?
Yes.
Okay.
You bet.
So bad as graveyards go, a little damp, but listen close, so you can hear the whispers of a sailor's ghost. On the day I sailed to sea, my mama cried, my daddy prayed, but it saved me from a banker's wage. So on the sea I stayed, on the sea I stayed. I sailed the seas to learn the stars, but I soon forgot them. On the day I came to rest upon the soggy bottom, see my pa there with his pipe, see my ma there in her gown, see me dance with all the girls in London town. Once I was a handsome man,
had a girl in every port. I lived to love them. I loved to leave them. I loved them just for sport. I loved them just for sport. I sailed the seas to learn the stars, but I soon forgot them. On the day I came to rest upon the soggy bottom, come ye sailors, drink until you roar. Don't you know your money ain't no good no more? Now and then you'll hear my ghost rushing out and rushing in. Can't you hear the tide is going out again? Let the others leave their tracks where the cold winds ever blow. See them in the violet hour paying what they owe. Stars, but I soon forgot him. On the day I came to rest upon the soggy bottom, as a lad I loved my kin, but I soon forgot him. Day I came to rest upon the soggy bottom, upon the soggy bottom.
Alex McMurray, you are a very talented man.
Well, thanks. But then Newbern turns to me and he says, well, I've never heard that one. And I say, wink, like, yeah, John, well, it's a little obscure, you know. I got it from blah, 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 you know. And he's like, okay, yeah. So he lets me, you know, he keeps my, you know, keeps it cool. And then afterwards, he's like, listen, I've got a book you can borrow, you know.
Oh, nice.
So
what's so ironic is that Upon the Soggy Bottom was one of the songs I was going to ask you to play.
Oh, really?
Without ever knowing the story behind it. It's a gorgeous song.
Oh, yeah.
It really is. I wanted to ask you, and this might be a creative challenge. I was wondering if you might be able to sing Captain Sandy.
Captain Sandy.
Your song, Captain Sandy, in a way that will not get WWNO's operating license revoked.
We can try.
Do the Captain Sandy dance. Wear the Captain Sandy pants. Listen while he raisin' rants. He's Captain Sandy. Captain Sandy lives alone, works alone, sleeps alone. Listen to him whine and moan. He's Captain Sandy. Hand me down my shiny boots, my dear. Captain Sandy drinks his weight in beer. Oh, when Captain Sandy takes a bow, no one applauds because they don't know how. He dreams of scuttle in the scow. He's Captain Sandy. Oh, we're away. has the skipper been? His grip on things is loosening. And what's behind the toothless grin of Captain Sandy? Captain Sandy's at the wharf, he's drinking with a one-armed dwarf. Run and see the same man morphing to Captain Sandy. Arr, he doth command a crew of one. Bit by bit the captains come undone. Oh, why does Captain Sandy drool? He failed mousketeering school. Ah, face down in the swimming pool is Captain Sandy. Oh, would you walk the plank? Oh, would you skip the rope? Ooh. And I'm gonna keel haul the lot of y'all, yeah. Ooh, yeah. Oh, Mick and Min and all the gang, they all came down to see him hang. And someone in the crowd got up and sang, it's Captain Sandy. Ah, and he was lifted from the noose. He grabbed his Captain Sandy boots. Lock your doors, he's on the loose. He's Captain Sandy. Drink your troubles by the cup, my friends. Captain Sandy breaks before he bends. Ooh, Captain Sandy disappeared. And he's gone, they say, with all of his gear. But sailors' hearts still know the fear of Captain Sandy. Captain Sandy. Captain Sandy. Captain Sandy.
Fabulous.
It's the wailing of lost souls, ladies and gentlemen.
Singer-songwriter Alex McMurray. Where's he going next? Back in a minute. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. When Louisiana musicians go a-traveling, there's no telling what might happen. Country music singer-songwriter Jim McCormick was born and raised in Algiers, Louisiana, and studied to be a poet. For the past several years, he's been commuting regularly between New Orleans and Nashville, where he has a full-time job writing songs for a variety of performers. In 2012, he and Brantley Gilbert co-wrote Gilbert's number one song, You Don't Know Her Like I Do.
'Cause you don't know like I do. You never understand. And you don't know we've been through. You think my best friend, and there's no way you're gonna help me. She's the only one who can. No, you don't know how much I've got to lose. You don't know like I do.
Later that year, McCormick did it again, co-writing a song that brought Jason Aldean to the top.
Well, I'm just ready to ride this Chevy down a little back road. Find your pretty little cell phone. Get a little closer, turn up the radio. Put your pretty pink toes on the dash. Lean the seat back. Man, I swear there ain't nothing looks better than that. Sweet tan little thing with nothing to do. I wanna take a little ride with you.
Bjorn Borg, the great tennis pro, said that there's only number one. There is no other number that is relevant. So, Jim McCormick, do you agree?
Well, you know, this season, I can go along with that. I've had all the other numbers. This is a better number to have than the others.
Yes.
I feel very blessed and very fortunate by it happening. And it's certainly something that's far out of my control. You know, the last thing that was in my control was composing those songs.
Wow.
And so since then, there's been a team of musicians and producers and singers and radio promotion people, and good luck and all of those things at work.
That's true.
On our behalf, so.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, nobody can take complete credit, but it has to start with somebody putting some words on a page, doesn't it?
I own that. I'll own that part of it. I really will. That's okay.
So what does it do? I mean, it must do something for you in terms of your self-confidence, in terms of, as well as like commercial, you know, I mean, the commercial aspects of success, of a number one success. You know, do you get to sort of join a kind of a club almost?
You do. I'll address that first. You know, the outward difference is measurable. The doors open, your phone rings, you do belong to a club. You now have a sort of 3-minute calling card.
Yeah.
He's the guy that wrote that song. You can be the guy that had a whole lot of great songs cut and all that, and there's nobody knows those songs, you know, for a long time. And of course, the exposure, the commercial return, all of that is significant. Internally, it's a real trip because because it does give you a little more confidence. You're unprepared for how to handle that confidence. You're unprepared. You know, I have told a friend of mine that I've spent the last 12 years in Nashville learning how to smile while getting my teeth kicked in. And that's just because the nature of what songwriters do is to hear the word no more than anything else. And we become comfortable and accustomed to that and continue to fight and work hard and wake up every morning and go write like our life depends on it again and have a great time doing it. You know, I mean, the paradise is the road to paradise, right?
That's right.
And so I've been on that road a long time, and I still think I'm on that road. And I try to compartmentalize the success in a way that just lets me continue to do what I've been doing. Maybe I get to do it a little bit smarter and a little bit more strategically. But for the most part, I still work with the same people that I have for the last few years. And not a lot internally has changed as far as my process, but there is, you mentioned that confidence, and I've got to say that really the biggest difference for me internally is that it's within reach.
Yes.
It is, as a matter of fact, within reach. And before, you were only told it was within reach.
Right.
And now you go into work and you realize, today I might write my boy's college education. Today,
that's right.
Today I might do this, you know, and that puts a little bounce in your step. It certainly makes you, I think, a little more focused and ready to work.
Well, did you do anything for yourself? Did you ever, you know, did you dream with your wife sitting there, okay, one day I'm going to have a number one song, and when I have a number one song, we're going to do X. Did you do anything like that?
We're going to quit sweating when I have a number one song, you know. No, nothing big.
Okay.
You know, I think we'll find a way to carve out a celebration of some kind here or there. But
no Cadillac,
no. I think our toys are going to look a lot boring. You know,
a new refrigerator.
A new refrigerator. You know, a better insurance plan, or you know,
exactly.
Yes, right.
We all need one. It's true. But, you know, songwriters are really my heroes because your work can be so personal, but at the same time, it can come out of so many different people's mouths, you know, very, very different people, you know. And it's like a great song is kind of like those traveling pants, you know, that story about the traveling pants, where, you know what I mean? It can fit anybody, you know, without really having to tailor the song. How do you work toward that?
I mean, those are some great descriptions of writing at its best right there, Gwen. It really is. And I think I'm very fortunate that I come from some excellent teachers, not all of which are songwriters, you know, some poets, some scholars. And so, you know, I'm trying to give the listener something to inhabit that's out of my own life. And you know, how do I do that? I don't know. I can only follow the sort of the truth meter in me and the beauty meter in me and use that to hopefully create something that will trigger that same space for somebody else to inhabit.
Couldn't remember how it felt to be loved. I was standing on the edge of giving.
life's all about. Oh, but thanks to you, girl, it's all coming back to me now. Yeah, the sun.
Country music legend Ronnie Millsap singing It's All Coming Back to Me Now, a song written by John Mabe, Patrick Jason Matthews, and our guest, Jim McCormick. The musicians we've heard from so far have talked about challenges they met on the road, but John Cleary is unique. Cleary sounds like a New Orleanian, but he's come a long way. From Kent, the Garden of England, to the Ninth Ward.
You're way too cool to treat that sweet thing right. Your good thing. I'm trying to tell you the program's changed. I'm gonna step on in.
My mum just would melt every time, you know, if Teddy Buckner's version of West End Blues would come on. She'd just stop whatever she was doing, close her eyes, and just start swooning. And that, well, you know, my family were really moved by music. And when you observe this stuff when you're a little kid. My musical taste came really from within my family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in England in the 70s, growing up when I did, we had two music programs that came on.
Okay.
On the television. We only had three television channels. And at 7:20 on a Thursday, you could watch Top of the Pops. You could read the charts, chart hits. And that was the 70s. It was the era of glam rock, and I hated the Bay City Rollers and Gary Glitter and Sweet and all these daft bands. But there was another program that would come on called the Old Grey Whistle Test, which was, you know, more adult, sophisticated rock. And that would be guys doing 10-minute noodly guitar solos, and I didn't really like that either. And I was a guitar player. I started playing guitar when I was a kid. My dad showed me all his, you know, they'd have sessions down at the pub, and they'd all come back home afterwards, and there'd be music in the front room, everybody playing. And so that's how I learned to play.
Were there any songs in particular that you remember and you remember very well as songs that kind of helped nudge you into the direction of either playing guitar or of taking up music professionally?
Well, there was at school we had one record player and about five records. It was a little parochial village school called Collier's Green. I think there were about 30 students in the whole school.
Wow.
And they had a tiny little record, little box record player. And one of the records was Can't Buy Me Love. This would have been about 1967, I'm guessing, or 68, 69, something. So the record was already like 5 or 6 years old. But the guitar solo kind of rang a bell. And I was only a kid. I would have been about 7 or 8 years old.
The Beatles.
And then when I was about 14, punk rock happened, and sure. That was really exciting. Sex Pistols and the Damned and the Clash, and me and my mates would bunk off school and get on the bus to Hastings and go and see the Stranglers.
We came across the West Sea. We didn't have much idea of the kind of climate waiting. We used our hands for guidance, like the children of a preacher, like a dry tree seeking water. Or a daughter, nice and sleazy, does it every time.
Every punk gig, they would have a reggae band. All of a sudden, there's this explosion in great reggae music. So we got to see these hip bands that were coming over from Jamaica. And that's still one of my big passions. When I'm relaxing, I listen to Caribbean reggae music.
That's lovely. And so your friends, did they have the same aspirations that you had? I mean, to become musicians or?
No, there was no musicians around. I was the only one, really.
But it must have been kind of odd to them, the idea that you guys are hanging out, you're watching, you know, reggae, you're listening to punk, and you are playing, you know, sort of New Orleans music. Or...
I know. When I get home, I'd be listening to Professor Long and trying to figure out, you know. Big Chief, you know, all this stuff. So there were two different compartments to my music. The punk thing was dreadful, but they actually played with a lot of energy.
Yes.
And that I really picked up on. And then when I came to New Orleans, when you see 70-year-old men getting down in a street parade playing, they got all the energy, all the soul, and they could play too. It's like, thank you.
It's true.
That's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
I wasn't getting in England.
Punk plus musicality.
Just the attitude where you dig in and you play hard. You know, you work, and you work, you bust a sweat.
Ready?
Confusion, passes of illusion. And we down here trying to make it while you're all bits are breaking. Oh, Lord,
Crazy Up in Here. That's John Cleary and the Absolute Monster Gentleman. And you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Sean Collins, Jason Ryan, and Rick G. Nelson. Our theme song was written and performed by James Booker. The general manager of WWNO is Paul Mawson. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Music Inside Out is underwritten by the Historic New Orleans Collection, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, and WWNO. For more information on how you can support our program, go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.